Then the blade fell, and the architect of the terror was silenced forever. Some histories of the French Revolution end here in year two of the New Republic, 5 years after the stirring events of July 1789. The fall of Robespierre certainly marked a turning of the tide of revolution. Within weeks of his death, the Thermidorians, as they would soon be called, had dismantled the principal machinery of revolutionary government. The law of the 22nd of Prairial was an early casualty, repealed on the 1st of August. Thousands of prisoners were released, including leading Girondins who had escaped the guillotine. Terror would continue for much of the next year, but now it was directed against the terrorists of 1793 and 1794. Carrier, the arch-terrorist of Nantes, and prosecutor Fouquier-Tinville were both executed, and in the provinces revenge attacks on Jacobins were frequent and bloody. Meanwhile, in Paris, a new breed of activist appeared on the streets, the jeunesse dorée, or gilded youth, whose dandyish affectations belied the sheer brutishness with which they enforced the Thermidorian order. The Jacobin Club was attacked and closed in November 1794. Revolutionary government itself was formally suspended in April 1795. The political pendulum had swung decisively to the right. Paris had not seen the last of its journée. After the worst winter of the century, sans-culottes demanding bread and the Constitution of 1793 marched on the convention in April and May 1795, the risings of the 12th of Germinal and the 1st of Prairial. But the deputies were no longer to be cowed by such mass activism, even when one of their number was killed and his head brandished on a pike in the convention chamber. Another rising in October, the 13th of Vendémiaire, was prompted by popular anger at the new constitutional arrangements of 1795, which were widely seen as undemocratic. The insurrection was defeated in part by artillerymen deployed outside the Tuileries, who fired cannon into the advancing crowds, the first time the army had been used against Parisian civilians since before the Revolution. The incident revitalized the career of their commander, Napoleon, now General Bonaparte, who had been drafted in by Barras. After the 13th of Vendémiaire, the government structures of the 1795 constitution were put in place. In November, a five-man directory took over central executive power, vowing to replace with a new social order the chaos which always accompanies revolutions. It was a desire widely shared by a people weary of change. The directory, under various personnel, which always included Barras, would remain the central organ of government in France for the next 4 years. This was a period of seesaw politics, during which, against a backdrop of massive economic disruption, the directors navigated a choppy course between the extremes of Jacobinism and resurgent royalism. As the Vendémiaire rising had shown, however, it was the army which increasingly determined the outcome of crises. And in 1799, as the Directory struggled to contain endemic political unrest, it was the army which stepped in again, in the person of its most ambitious commander. On the 9th of October, Napoleon Bonaparte, by now the hero of one of the most breathtaking campaigns in military history, the Italian campaign of 1796-1797, returned to France from his Egyptian expedition against the British. A month later, he seized power in the coup of the 18th of Brumaire and was declared first consul. On the 15th of December 1799, a new constitution, the Constitution of the Year 8, was presented to the French people. "Citizens," the proclamation declared, "the revolution is established on the principles with which it began. It is over." 5 years later, on the 2nd of December 1804, Bonaparte was crowned Napoleon I, Emperor of the French. So what are we to make of it all, this decade and more of upheaval in the heart of Europe? The legacy of the French Revolution has been argued over as fiercely as its causes. It is all too easy to see in its excesses the template for the great totalitarian repressions of the 20th century. but its ideals underpin much of what we now take for granted in the world's liberal democracies. Just as the most enduring of its rallying cries for liberté, égalité, fraternité, liberty, equality, fraternity, reminds us of how much we have yet to achieve. Because for all the blood, for all the petty score-settling and institutional paranoia, the revolution was also a genuine outgrowth of the Enlightenment. For better or worse, it was the enterprise of men consciously engaged in a drama of utopian ambition, nothing less than the moral recreation of humanity through the remaking of a nation. We have only to look at the centuries since to see how tragically they failed in that wider aim. But the history of ideas may sometimes have a longer reach than the history of events. Perhaps, then, the last word should belong to the veteran of another revolution, the former Chinese premier, Zhou Enlai. The story goes that Zhu was once asked to comment on the significance of the French Revolution. His answer has itself become part of revolutionary folklore. It is too early to say.